Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning to you, everybody, and I want to welcome you guys to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Today we have a killer show for you, and that's no pun intended. First up, we're going to have authors John Land and Robert Fitzpatrick, who wrote a nonfiction book called Betrayal, Whitney Bulger and the FBI agent who brought him down, which we're going to have that on. Robert Fitzpatrick will be on. And then later, we're going to have Richard Codrey coming on to talk about his latest Sandman Slim book. So we're action-packed here, and everything's going to go on really fast at a quick pace. So you got about 1 minute to come back, because 1 hour of Suspense Radio starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're going to like it. I think you're going to feel you belong.
So I want to welcome everybody back. We are here back with another great episode on Saturday, January the 14th. Thank you for joining us wherever you are at. So we're going to jump right in here with our first guest, like I said, author John Land, FBI agent Robert Fitzpatrick, together in a book called Betrayal, which was out January the 3rd. I want to welcome Robert and John to the show. Thank you guys so much for coming on. How are you doing this morning?
Well, thank you, John.
We're doing well, John. How are you?
Hey, you know what? I can't do bad because it's been 73 degrees here and sunny in L.A., so you can't complain at that for the last week.
Just rub it in. Rub it in. It's okay.
We're on the East Coast.
It's 14 degrees.
And you guys are getting nice weather, so, hey, winter's come. Winter's come. You got to pay for paradise, though, in L.A. And you guys know all about
that.
There you go.
So let's talk a little bit about Betrayal. Like I said here, Whitney Bulger and the FBI agent who brought him down, which we have here, of course, Mr. Robert Fitzpatrick, John Land, of course, author, best-selling author of many different books. You can find out information about the book, too, on johnlandbooks.com. So, guys, how did this book kind of come together? I guess, you know, maybe whose idea? How did you guys get together in order to write it? Tell a little bit about the behind-the-scenes action of it.
John, you want
to
do
that? I was introduced to Bob through some mutual friends who knew he was in the midst of trying to write a book about his experiences in the FBI and, you know, tracking and hunting and going after Whitey Bulger for a number of years. So they put us together. We had lunch, and I knew two things, John. I knew two things from the first 5 minutes that we were together. One, that this was a bestseller, and two, that it was one of these very rare nonfiction tales that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It had complete three acts, and I saw it. I saw the whole book in my head right from the start. Of course, the final product is a lot different than what I saw in my head.
Right.
It's a lot better than what I ever expected it would be. And I think, in all honesty, this is my 31st book, my first work of nonfiction. I think I'm more proud of this book. I'm more proud of Betrayal than any book I've ever done.
I can second that, John, in terms of I had put together about 200, 300 words, or pages, I should say, and was grappling with the whole idea of writing this. And, of course, Bulger, for your viewers or your listeners who don't know who he is, he's probably one of the biggest criminals on the East Coast, particularly in Boston. He's a guy who's been named in about 23 different murders, and altogether maybe 43. But the interesting part is that he was an FBI informant. And as an FBI informant and a murderer, if that's all holds true, he's a very dangerous guy. So I was transferred to the Boston Division from headquarters, FBI headquarters, and my job basically was to stop some of the problems at Boston, identify the people who were leaking information to the bad guys, and gals for that matter, and also to assess, to look at this guy Bulger and determine his trustworthiness, if I could use that word.
Now, the one thing that always kind of fascinates me, of course, when you watch all the shows on the ID channel and everything, and like you said, Robert, you were transferred into Boston. How does that go? I mean, do they come to you and they say, you know, with your experience and your background, we want you to go over here and do this? I mean, was it? I mean, how does that situation kind of work?
Not quite, John. The FBI is a quasi-military organization, sometimes more military and sometimes more quasi. But as an organization, you're ordered in, you see. It's not like you could turn around and say, geez, I don't want to go, you know, because then they'd show you the door and you'd be out the door. So basically, you do what you're told to do, and I was brought in. I was told that basically there's a problem in Boston, that it's a big problem. And because of my past experience, I had done some work in Miami as an economic crime supervisor, and some of your listeners may recall ABSCAM, which was a major, major white-collar crime investigation. And also, I was involved in another operation involving police who had gone bad and became cop killers, or rather became killers as cops for the cartel, for the drug cartel. And that was a real nasty situation. So having more or less cleaned some of that up, when I went back to headquarters, I was a unit chief for a major job, and they called me in and said, we're sending you to Boston. That's basically the way it went.
And then all of a sudden, boom, you're right in the middle here of the, you know, Whitey Bulger and everything, and then you're kind of off and running. And then, John, you kind of jump in here, and then you hear the story, and you start going, you know, how fascinating once you started to get into, I guess, start digging in a little further about what's going on. I mean, how did your brain, for lack of a better term, I mean, how did it just start spinning with all the information you were getting that the normal public doesn't understand?
No, that's a great question. And the good thing is I came into this as a member of the normal public because I knew very little of the story. And the more I researched and the more I read what Bob had written, the more we talked, you know, for hours and hours and hours about his experiences. And then I started researching to corroborate everything Bob said because I knew we would get challenged. And I would uncover things like when Bob, what he's not telling you is that when he was in running ABSCAM, he also uncovered corruption not only in the Miami office of the FBI, which he dealt with, but he uncovered cops in the Miami PD who were working as hitmen and dealers for the drug cartels. This later gave birth to one of the most famous or infamous, I should say, cases of public corruption in the history of law enforcement in this country, what is now known as the Miami River murders, where 218 cops were fired and 20 went to jail. Bob uncovered that years before it came to light. This is before he came to Boston. So this was just the tip of the iceberg, in other words. What I was uncovering about his experiences, because the thing about Bob Fitzpatrick is he wasn't just an ordinary FBI agent who took over as the second in command of the Boston office. This was a man who had played a leading role in the takedown of Sam Bowers in the famous bombings in Mississippi that became Mississippi Burning the movie. He found the gun that James Earl Ray used to assassinate Martin Luther King while he was in charge of the security detail, the FBI security detail, and of course that gun is what led to Ray's arrest in London a few months later. You know, so his experience, in addition to Abscam, was pretty elaborate. He had been through all these major cases. In other words, John, he was the perfect man for a job the FBI then didn't let him do once they sent him to Boston. And there is the cruel Shakespearean irony of the entire thing. Sending a man to do a job and then stopping him from doing it, and that's exactly what happened.
And then, of course, you're not only dealing, like you said, you know, when you have an FBI informant, and just to let people know, you know, because a lot of people might not understand, when you're an FBI informant, but you're a top criminal, how does that kind of work within the FBI when you're talking about this guy's a very dangerous criminal, like you said, upwards of 43 murders, but then on the other side, they use him to try to help, but just when you go on the site here and you start reading and you read into the book, it's not like he was that helpful in times. So how does that kind of work back and forth together, Robert?
John, the informant program isn't always at the top level, what they call top echelon. And Whitey, of course, was a top echelon. Normally it's reserved for organized crime people who are right at the top, and you can't get that information normally. So you got to go to the bad guys and have the information spelled out to you. And even though they're bad guys, I mean, you're not going to get it from Walter Boys. So you got to use these bad people. And the hook for that whole thing is that the agents are savvy enough to understand that they're dealing with bad people who are giving them good information that should be verified. And that out of this, they get the leaders. You know, they get the Gottis, and they get the other mobsters in different parts of the United States, whether it be New York or Boston or L.A. or Chicago or whatever, Giancano. But the fact of the matter is that informants are by and large, criminals. You're right. And with Whitey, all that stuff wasn't exactly known the way we now know it. There was a lot of stuff about Whitey that was hidden. And obviously, the more you get into it, the more you start investigating this guy, the more you found out what really bad stuff he was doing. But John, by then, he was inside. He was an FBI informant. And unfortunately, people thought that they should protect him. And that is the nub of the whole book. That's what betrayal is about, that you're really protecting a bad guy and not the good guys. And so somehow they lost their way.
Now,
does that make any sense?
John, yeah, I mean, it does make sense. I mean, and the other thing is that, you know, John writes, you know, fiction books and has to create these villains and characters basically, you know, from your imagination. You, however, are looking at these villains eye to eye and having to talk to them and everything else. So from two different sides of the spectrum, you almost want to say which is more, I guess, I don't know, which is more scary, but it's like when you're looking at a guy face to face and you're having to deal with them, that kind of gives you, it's kind of give you some kind of uneasy feeling. And John, I don't know if you were able to, you know, to speak with them or do that kinds of thing, but it's much different than when you're just creating somebody out of thin air and writing them in a fiction book.
Well, let me just say one thing. I feel like the lobster, you know, like when you put the lobster in alive, the lobster really doesn't know when it's cooked, you know.
Right.
And so during that process, you're not aware about how dangerous it's going to get, and so that becomes a real problem.
And
but
John,
go ahead.
Getting back to the point you raised, and it's an excellent point. I think I was the perfect person to team up with Bob on Betrayal because of my fictional background. Because what I did was exactly what you just said. I went about this as the drafts went forward, and there were many, many drafts that we did, like it was a novel. So I was, instead of trying to make fictional characters seem real, I was taking a real person and ascribing fictional qualities onto him to develop him as the kind of hero that he is. And the fascinating thing here, John, and you know this better than anyone because you read so many thrillers, you know the genre better than anyone. There are certain qualities of the thriller hero, and it goes back to the old frontier hero in Western literature. And this is, you know, true heroes are isolated. They sacrifice. But in the end, they find a form of salvation, redemption, vindication. All of these three things were true. If you look at The Structure of Betrayal, which is a true story in the life of Bob Fitzpatrick and him taking on arguably the most notorious gangster of the modern era, I don't really think it's even arguable, way above John Gotti, in my opinion, Whitey Bulger. It's you look at the book and you read my Caitlin Strong books. Well, the similarities are striking. And I didn't invent this, by the way. This was invented by Truman Capote in Cold Blood.
John, that's a good point. You know, well,
we used to laugh
at how unbelievable it sounded. And John, you know, of course, it was believable. And John was able to take that and make it believable. Because when you tell the story otherwise, you know, people say, oh, come on, you know, that never happened. But as John relates to you, it happened.
And I'll tell you, John, if I had proposed a book to my publisher about a criminal who basically murdered, stole, robbed, extorted, strong-armed his way to the tortured, to the top of the criminal, to the top of the criminal underworld in New England and in many ways across the country and across the Atlantic to the Irish and the IRA and all that. If I had told that story and said this guy corrupted the FBI and the FBI actually aided, abetted him, and were accessories to his actions, my publisher would have said, that's too incredible to believe. You can't write that book. And here it is. I've written that book as nonfiction because it happened. And I've got to tell you, you never know, and you've heard me say this before, you never know what you have with a book until it comes out and people start reading it and you start seeing the reviews.
Right.
But especially especially regular readers. And I have to tell you, 31 books, I've never had so many people say the magic words, which are the greatest words a thriller writer can hear. I couldn't put the book down. And when I started the process, that's what I was hoping to do, except the bar was much higher. Because unlike fiction, you made this point a minute ago, John, you're making it all up in fiction. It's the exact opposite with Betrayal. Because everything had to be corroborated. Everything had, even though it's first person, when you look at the end notes, you know that everything Bob is saying is true because I source it. So it's the antithesis. It's the exact opposite of fiction in one sense. But structurally, it's the same thing.
Hey, John, let me just paraphrase some of that. You know, when you look at Bulger as the FBI guy, the protocol and the regulations of the FBI, you know, dictate that an informant really can't be the person in charge of the gang. And yet Bulger was the head of the Winter Hill Gang, which was an Irish gang as bad, as far as I'm concerned, as the Mafia. Secondly, you know, Bulger had already told his handlers, FBI guys, that he was not going to testify against anybody. And that as far as he was concerned, you know, he was going to just keep his mouth shut. Well, hello? You're an informant. You can't keep your mouth shut. And that was verified in what we call the race fix case, where the strike force chief, the strike force attorney, eventually said before Congress, you got me, meaning that he let Bulger off this stuff and what would normally be an obstruction of justice case. So, of course, Bulger feels very powerful now. And then finally, you know, Bulger said he had inside informants in the state police, in the Boston police, local police, and so forth. And I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. You can't let this guy be an informant. I mean, for all those reasons above, I mean, it seems common sense to me. So when I went out and interviewed him, obviously I didn't buy his act at all. And I said,
right.
Hey, you know, I'm out of here. You're closed. And, of course, that's when everything turned upside down.
And the thing the thing is that's important to note here, there are many people in Southern California in your area who are familiar with Bulger because that's where he was caught, so they know the story.
Right.
But to this day, most people who know the story will say this whole debacle was the result of one or two rogue agents. What we reveal in Betrayal, and this is really the first time it's been authenticated from the inside, is that this conspiracy of corruption, this culture of corruption, went beyond two rogue agents to the highest levels of the Bureau in Washington. We name these names. It went into the Department of Justice in the person of the man, Jeremiah O'Sullivan, that Bob just alluded to, the head of the Organized Crime Strike Force. Even William Weld, the future governor of Massachusetts, and at then the U.S. attorney for the state of Massachusetts, bears some responsibility because Bob Fitzpatrick had three informants who were capable of giving Bulger up to him to make it impossible for the FBI to keep him open on the books as a top echelon informant. The first informant was a man named Brian Halloran. Bob went to Jeremiah O'Sullivan, and then over his head when O'Sullivan refused to put Halloran in witness protection to Bill Weld. Bill Weld refused to overrule O'Sullivan, and 2 weeks later, Halloran was machine gunned to death by Whitey Bulger because the information had been leaked.
Machine gunned in broad daylight.
Outside a bar in South Boston. This is all true. You can't make this stuff up, John. That's the amazing thing.
I'm sitting here, and I'm literally, reading the book, and when you're going, not only does it go from 0 to 60 in, 0.6 seconds and beyond, but, the writers of 24 couldn't put this together.
can I quote you on that?
Yeah, you
can
put it together. Brian Grazer, he lives in Santa Monica, he couldn't put this together. When if people read the background of who Whitey Bulger is, he's more dangerous than any fictional person that you could think of in your head to make him as ruthless as you wanted to. And the guy's still alive. Did you mail him a copy of the book? I got to know that.
This is actually a good story. Bob, tell him the story.
Yeah, I just learned that one of my people told me that he's got the book and he's reading it in jail. And now they're going to send the Hollywood team out there. I think it's Damon and his crew. I'm not sure.
Or Mark.
But they want to talk to him about writing a movie about the guy and the victims in this case. And you got to understand, John, there's a lot of victims. There's, you're talking about families and kids and people that this guy, he murdered their father, if you will, but he destroyed families left and right. He put in cocaine in Southie and destroyed so many children and so forth. Anyway, they want to glorify this guy? They want to make him a good guy? No way.
Yeah.
Not if I have any say.
That's the thing, is that it's very difficult for those Hollywood people. It's almost like they go and then they try to make them, they try to glorify them. The man is the bottom of the shoe scum that you scrape off your bottom of your shoe. That's basically who he is. And it's just amazing, to getting into the book and to see the behind the scenes of everything that goes on. I don't know. It takes a certain strong man like yourself, Bob, to be able to handle just the mental capability of being able to do these things for so long and dealing with people like this.
It's a challenge. And as a kid, I always wanted to be an FBI agent, and I became an FBI agent. And perhaps too idealistically, or whatever you want to call it, I believe in the Bureau. I believe in justice. I believe that people should get a fair deal all the time, bad guys and good guys. But in this case, you could use the bad guys against the bad guys, but it turned out they were using the bad guys against the good guys. And that's not right. That's, that's not justice. That's not fairness. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
And, the interesting thing here is Bob left the Bureau in early 1987, late 1986, after a series of, they were basically out to get him at that point. He had become persona non grata, and finally they won. He left the Bureau. That was 1987. He never gave up the chase. Just because he left the Bureau, he never stopped trying to get Bulger. And the great thing about this book, when I said it had a beginning, middle, and an end, the climax of the book, the book opens with the torture murder of a third informant named John McIntyre. And this is a brutal scene to open a book. The opening line is, "You want a bullet in the head." That the climax of the book is a trial where the family of the murdered John McIntyre in 2006 sues the Justice Department /FBI for complicity in the murder. At that trial, Bob testifies, and as I said, that's the climax of the book, a very tense, suspenseful courtroom scene, where for the first time, Bob was able to tell his story in a forum that mattered. And the judge, a great judge named Judge Lindsay, Reginald Lindsay, wonderful man. I've listened to the tapes, and you can hear him saying things under his breath. And it's literally unbelievable to listen and to read the transcripts of all this coming out, to see vindication. It reminded me, the only thing I can remember like this was the Army-McCarthy hearings. The
yeah.
moment where McCarthy accused Joseph, the moment where Joseph Walsh, the great lawyer the Army had hired, said, "Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you no sense of decency?" And there's this moment in this Boston courtroom where the whole world realized the FBI was guilty. Until that point, you know, there was this and there was that and there were stories and there was subterfuge and it was a few bad apples and it was something they had fixed. And then comes this trial and Bob Fitzpatrick's testimony blew it out of the water.
You know, John, in a word, nobody wanted the story to come out. But as an FBI agent, I took an oath to do the job. And it's
right.
a story that had to be told. And if nothing else, to keep it from happening again. I mean, that's where it's at.
Oh, great point.
Yeah.
You don't want this to happen again. And so it's a learning experience. And unfortunately for the FBI, it took the other part of the judiciary to tell them, hey, look, you know, you screwed up.
Yeah.
And to this day, no one's ever said they're sorry. You know, they don't say they're sorry. That's
right.
not part of anything. But on the other hand, the story's out there. And it is, unfortunately, a betrayal.
Well, guys, I want to tell you what. Time flew so fast. That we're already done. I could literally sit here for another 3 hours and talk about this because, I mean, this is what Great Suspense Radio is all about, is right here. And I want to thank you guys so much for coming on because the book is called Betrayal. Whitney Bulger and the FBI agent who brought him down. And that's Robert Fitzpatrick, who's joining us now with author John Land. Guys, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And, again, whether people are fan, you know, they read thrillers and they say, oh, nonfiction, true crime, this is so different than what you think of a true crime book that it's faster than any really fast-paced thriller that you're going to pick up here. And the book is out. It was out January 3rd. So
hey,
I want to thank you guys so much for coming on.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Fabulous. We'll talk again. And you guys take it easy. And Robert, you know, like you said, you know, you always dreamed of being an FBI agent. Well, sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for, too.
I'll let you keep my back.
All right. And thank you guys again so much. Enjoy your day.
Take care.
Thank you, John.
All right.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that was John Land and Robert Fitzpatrick talking about the book they wrote together called Betrayal, Robert Fitzpatrick, the FBI agent who helped bring down Whitey Bulger. And if you want to read a little bit about Whitey Bulger, not only is the story here in the book Betrayal, but you can go on and see exactly who this man is. And if you don't get goosebumps, then you probably have no heartbeat, because that's what you're going to get when you read the book Betrayal and just to know everything behind the scenes. So we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back with our next guest, which is Richard Caudry, and he's going to be talking about his latest Sandman Slim novel. So we will see you here in about 3 minutes, 4 minutes. You never know. But in the meantime, here you go.
But now I've come back.
Back, everybody, and I want to thank you all again for joining us today. We had just had John Land and Robert Fitzpatrick on with their book, Betrayal. Robert Fitzpatrick, the FBI agent who brought down Whitey Bulger, John Land, the best-selling author who wrote the book along with Robert. Like I said, you can go to johnlandbooks.com to find out more about that. The book is out. Make sure you get it today. We are jumping right in here to our next guest. And he is the author of the Sandman Slim novels, and we are so pleased to welcome Richard Codrey to the radio show today. Richard, how are you doing?
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
So the latest book in Sandman Slim is called Aloha from Hell. You know, that's kind of, I love the title, nothing like Aloha and from Hell. Got to have them both in there. So the book came out in October 2011, so it's been out for a while. You got some, yeah. I mean, it's greatly reviewed, fabulous book. I mean, it's a perfect, you know, addition here to your Sandman Slim books that you have going on. Can you tell everybody about the book, you know, kind of how Sandman kind of, you know, progressed in, from the previous to now, and, you know, what kind of havoc you like to throw it around, you know, this time?
Well, Sandman, the first book, Sandman Slim, you had the character James Stark is a guy who escaped from hell, and he came back to, it's a revenge story, the very first one, to find the people who sent him there and the ones who murdered his girlfriend. So you start out with a very simple character who's looking straight up for revenge on a lot of bad, bad people. The third book is him having to go back to hell and find another group of the leftovers from that same group who are now in hell, who've kidnapped the soul of his girlfriend, and to clean up the mess he left behind, to get her and, you know, to just navigate back through the worst place in the universe.
And when you're writing something like, you know, when you're writing about, you know, I guess you want to say a setting, you know, kind of like hell, and this is, you know, supernatural thriller suspense that you're doing, you can almost kind of, you know, since it's a place where, you know, technically no one really visited and really talked about, I guess, you know, you can't really ask people. It's not like going to New York and be able to write those things around. How are you able to, you know, I mean, you just have to kind of use all your creative juices to kind of take the place further into where, you know, the people kind of get the idea of what's going on and how your character has to kind of navigate through all of the outside things, not just from, you know, what he has to encounter in his head, you know, face to face, but everything else around when you're talking about, you know, of course, going to hell and back.
Well, I chose the other way, which is hell is L.A. I mean, he gets... When he's in hell, he's an L.A. person. When he's in hell, he visualizes hell as L.A. So hell has a sunset. Hell has a Hollywood Boulevard. And he goes by the landmarks. It's all kind of distorted because it's hell. But
right.
Hell is L.A. You know, it goes back and forth.
And so, you know, thinking of, like, the, you know, you, it's kind of, you know, the different genre, like I said, like the supernatural, you know, a kind of thriller genre and things that you write. How difficult is it for you to kind of, you know, keep the two, I guess you want to say, together as like a marriage instead of making, you know, one kind of go off in one way and one going off in the other? Does that pose a problem when you're, you know, when you're writing a book like Aloha from Hell?
I think it's kind of how your brain works. You know, it's how mine does. I always thought of the books more as crime novels with supernatural elements to it rather than any kind of fantasy or science fiction thing with a bunch of, you know, noir tropes kind of nailed onto the edges. So, you know, if you see the world in kind of, if that's your point of view, I mean, I kind of have always seen the world in this kind of mix of the kind of ordinary, the things you stumble across in the street, plus the things that live in the shadows at the same time. And the books kind of take place in that interzone right between those two worlds. And, you know, ever since I was a kid, I kind of imagined those two worlds simultaneously. So it was never much of a problem to try and meld those two things because they were already there.
Yeah, I definitely get what you're saying, you know, depending on, and that's the great thing about, you know, when you're being an author to when you're being someone who wants to write, is that, you know, your brain, like you said, you know, kind of acts in that different way, more so, you know, differently than someone who's just picking up and reading your books. You know, and you've been doing this because you've published, you know, dozens and dozens of short stories along with, you know, many different, you know, books and things like that. You've been writing for quite some time. So do you think that, you know, this is kind of, you know, your... You know, this is like your forte. This is your comfort zone. This is where you're thriving. This is where your brain takes you every time.
Yeah, you know, it took me sort of 20 years to come back to who I was in the first place. You know, I tried a lot of other things along the way. And when I finally got back to the thing that made the most sense to me, that's when I had some success. So that kind of meant a lot to me to like, all right, you know, this is the right thing. This is the place I ought to be. Sandman Slim is the voice in my head. So that's what I'm going to run with right now.
And that, and that's kind of where, you know, you just keep, you know, like the book Aloha from Hell and, you know, all your other stories, along with all the other ones that you wrote. I mean, because they're kind of all, you know, a little on the different side. If you were to say somebody, of course, you know, we want them to pick up Aloha from Hell, which is another one of your books that you say, you know what, to kind of really get the sense of, you know, who I am as a writer, take a look at this one also, and, you know, which one of your books would you kind of let somebody know, this is where you can kind of get a good idea of maybe, you know, like, who you are?
Well, there's probably two, I'd have to say. One is my first novel, Metrophage, which is a cyberpunk novel set in, again, Los Angeles. So I've always seen the city itself as a very deep and complex character. So if you want to see another version of where I see L.A. and how I see it as this kind of living, bizarre creature, Metrophage, my first book, would be a good one. If you want to sort of get the sense of that combination of the ordinary day plus this kind of apocalyptic supernatural elements, I'd say my book Butcher Bird, which has a lot of themes in common with Sandman Slim.
Now, you mentioned before, like, you know, L.A. is kind of the hell and this, and you're from San Francisco. Is that, Is that that North Cal, SoCal kind of, you know, bantering back and forth that you're
in
there?
I know what you're talking about, man. No, I actually am from New York, and I lived in Texas before I got here. And I came to L.A. first, and I only ended up in San Francisco because I followed a girl up there. Then I got some work up there, so I stayed. But I love L.A. I mean, that's people think I hate L.A. because I make L.A. hell, but, like, that's what I like about L.A. I mean, L.A. is this crazy, venal company town, and I love it because it's so honest about it. I mean, L.A. is just this big animal you walk into with these big, you know, big teeth and these big grinning jaws, and you walk in there knowing what you're getting into. You know, it's a little closer to New York than San Francisco is because you can sort of get chewed up and lost there. But it's a whole other thing, too. I think it's that company town mentality. I mean, L.A., to me, is like a big coal mining town. Everyone's here to work in one industry. And everyone, you have to admit it, it's like everyone is in L.A. because they want to be in TV and movies. And it's all the kind of good and bad parts of that. Because it's all completely gets into class distinction, gets into who you know, what you know, how high are you up on a totem pole right now, and all the people who, you know, tried to make it and didn't, the people who almost made it, you know, it's a city of these ghosts of failure wandering the streets, this kind of success and desperation at the same time coexisting. And it's, you know, you got to love it for that. You got to, you know, it's a town of, you know, the high success people and the ghosts in the streets who didn't make it. And then you've got underneath there, you've got the porn industry, which again has its own hierarchy of the success people and the people who didn't make it. And then you have music and all the other, you know, kind of the media excess that attracts people to L.A. So I love the place and people, but people do think, you know, I'm being snotty about it. But I the way I write about it, it's my little love note to the most venal city in America.
Yeah, it's kind of like when people come out and they never know and they say, you know, well, what is L.A.? You know, it's not like a normal city. And I go, no, it has a little downtown and it has 100 suburbs and they're all different. And so you can go anywhere you want, and you're going to get a different feel. And every little different suburb you go into, you're going to have a different feel. And I say that's what it is. It's made up of 100 little small cities all together into one big city. And you're not going to find that anywhere.
Yeah, no. It's there's this sort of central island and a million little archipelagos who barely have contact with each other and are part of a city only through some technicality of law. You know, and usually because they were chewed up by the larger L.A. because there was something there. You go to the north and you get water. You are now part of our city because you have water and we say so.
I know.
You know, stuff like that. You sort of see a bit of that in the movie Chinatown where you sort of see the water scandal, which is a true story, the old water scandal back in the 40s. That's how L.A. works. It's like you're now part of us because it's like a mob racket. It's like you'd be part of our city. It's like a mob protection scheme. You know, be part of our town or you know, your little city hall might get knocked over.
Or, of course, get destroyed in the day after tomorrow by tornadoes. But we're speaking with Richard Condrey. You can find out, you know, his latest book here is Aloha from Hell. It's latest in the Sandman Slim novels. His website is RichardCondrey, KADREY.com, to find out information. He's going to have Aloha from Hell up on his webpage very shortly, but, of course, you can find it at Amazon and wherever books are sold. So, Richard, when you're looking at Aloha from Hell, and this is kind of a question that we're, you know, kind of asking authors because I think it kind of be able to get you to the crux of the book, but is there a sentence or maybe a scene in the book, Aloha from Hell, where you finished it and you wrote it and then you come back and you get it and you go, damn, man, I nailed that one. I don't know how I did it, and I don't know if I can duplicate it, but I nailed it on this one.
I'm real happy with the ending. I mean, the ending got to the place exactly where I wanted it to be, and that means a lot because if you can – you know, if you can end on a note where you think people are going to put the book down and go, I'm satisfied, if you can nail the ending on something. And I'm pretty proud of how and where I ended up in that one. So I really, you know, I really want to give people a great opening, kind of drag them in, and then really give them an ending that's really going to make them feel satisfied. You know, when you're walking out the door, just go, ah, yeah, you know, I spent all these hours on this, and it was worth it.
And what kind of feedback are you getting? I mean, because the book came out, you know, fabulous reviews. You know, I mean, it was just kicking it with great reviews. So, you know, how have your fans, you know, when they contact you and they email you or they see you on the road or things like that, what's like the one kind of common, you know, question or, you know, kind of sense that you always get from them, you know, after they read the book Aloha from Hell?
I leave Stark, James Stark, in a very odd place at the end of book three that I kind of don't want to say what it is.
Right.
And people are really, really want to know what the hell happens after because of this ambiguous place I left him. And that was kind of nice because it showed me that people did want more, that they actually cared about him. They cared about the series, and they wanted to see what the hell happens after I left him in this kind of odd predicament. So that was really gratifying to see that people actually gave a damn and wanted to see the next step. And that's why I just finished the fourth book, which takes place exactly 100 days after the third book.
And so when you were writing the book Aloha from Hell, which you said is the third in the series, and now you already had the idea and you already knew how that was going to transition over in the fourth book by leaving him hung up into that manner, you just kind of found a spot maybe where you're like, I'm stopping it here, and then I'm going to go with book four.
Well, you always want to, you know, you have to look at these things practically. I knew that my publisher wanted three books, and so I wanted to give people something where this could stop here, because I didn't know if they'd want a fourth book. So I had to give an ending in the third where, yes, you could be satisfied to stop here, but if you really wanted to continue, you'd be happy to see the next thing. You know, you'd want to see how this is resolved, but we could stop here. And it's that kind of game you have to play when you're not sure if you're going to do the next book or not. So it's kind of it's a balancing act between the writer and the publisher. It's like, you know, you want to leave it open-ended because I want to write more, but you don't know if the money people are going to want you to tell more of the story.
And I guess the question that, you know, a lot of authors don't realize, or a lot of people who are aspiring to be authors are, you know, let's say, yeah, that you get that two-book deal and you're starting to write, but doesn't the real kind of stress happen after you're finished, like you said, with that three-book deal, going, are they going to want a fourth one? You know, how does, you know, I mean, you just kind of sit around, you're like waiting, and then does the word come down pretty fast, or is it something that you kind of had to wait for to hear? How did that process kind of work?
Well, you kind of know if, you know, the series is successful or not, because what will happen is during the third book or toward the end of the third book, it's almost like, dating somebody for the first time. They'll start kind of hinting that they want to get to know you more.
Yeah.
So by around the third book, I knew the thing was going well because there were kind of, you could tell by the way that our dialogue was, that like there was interest in keeping the thing going. And, you know, so sometimes you don't know. In this case, definitely I had a pretty good feeling that there was going to be more. So that was really encouraging to, put everything I had into that book and to plan out the next one ahead of time. Because like I said, I knew where number three ended and I knew where number four would start if I got to write it. So it was great to be able to have that transition in my head beforehand. But like I said, it was because I already knew my publisher was interested. You know, with all this kind of book writing, any kind, whether you're writing a series or not, it is always that balancing act between whatever little artsy thing you want to do and the people with money, the commerce people. Are they going to want to do this? You know, it's always this tightrope act. So, you know, you got to keep both things in your mind at the same time. What do you want to do, and what do they want? And is there some place you can meet in the middle?
Now, did you do? Are you doing still? Are your fans being able to go out there and meet you? Are you still doing events coming up here in 2012? Were people able to go out and meet you? And I know that you, you know, people are able to go on your site and you can get a signed and scribed copy, it looks like, by, you know, emailing you, or, you know, you have an 888 number to call you. So are you out in the public? Are you out there? Are you going to events where your fans can talk with you and meet you in person?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be at places like probably the World Horror Convention, probably. I know I'm going to be at a place like WonderCon and the World Fantasy Convention. I've been kind of lax in planning the stuff for 2012 because the fourth book took a little longer than I thought, so I haven't planned it out. But I'm definitely going to be doing some conventions, probably Dragon Con. Some places like that. So, yeah, I will be out in the world. I'm not right now because I just finished up the new book. I need to decompress from that. But I'm doing stuff like I'm doing, like, your show, which is pretty fun. And I just did an interview with FearNet. And so there are things coming out that won't necessarily be me, my entire face, in your face. But, you know, I'm trying to plan to get out there in the world more. So, yeah, I hope that I can meet people. It's kind of fun, man.
And is that kind of, you know, a lot of authors like to just be behind their computer and write and say, here's my book, and maybe do a couple signings. But the social networking part, a lot of them, I see 50-50. 50% of them really love it. The other 50% are like, hey, you know, I'm going to just get a little bit into that. Kind of where do you lie? And is that something that, you know, is kind of difficult? Was it difficult for you to kind of, you know, have to get yourself out there like that? And by the way, WonderCon last year was the first time I didn't go, so I might go this year. So if I do, I'll go make sure I see you.
Cool. That sounds all right. I like the social networking stuff. I mean, you have to be careful because it could become your job. I mean, it can get so big that you could spend, you know, 90% of your time just doing Facebook. So it's another one of those balancing acts. I actually... Facebook these days, I try to keep under control, but I'm there all the time, and
it's addicting, isn't it? That thing is so damn addicting at times.
But that's why I have to sort of balance that out. So I will interact with them there, definitely, but I have to keep it under control. I Twitter a lot. Twitter is I really enjoy, because that's just, I can just blast things out and give things to people. I can make some stupid observation, or I can give people links to great articles or other books. And then get back to work. You know, it's Twitter's a small contained thing where, you know, you're getting glimpses into my brain, and then I can get some feedback there, and it's really fast. Unlike, you know, Facebook can be it's like writing letters. It can be this long correspondence, whereas Twitter, it's fast. You're in, you're out, you're on to the next thing. So I Twitter more than I do Facebook, because, like I said, Facebook can be a huge time sink. But I do interact with people there all the time. So I try to balance it out. But, you know, even on Facebook, if we communicate, you'll probably get a sentence or something. But, you know, I definitely do talk to people there.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, Facebook, I always consider it's more like a marriage. It's for the long haul. Twitter's more like the one-night stand kind of thing. You know, it's kind of...
Yeah, actually,
you know,
that's a good way to describe it, and it probably...
Yeah, that's kind of...
I prefer the one-night stand.
So, well, Richard, I'll tell you what. I want to thank you so much for coming on. Fascinating stuff here. The book Aloha from Hell is a fascinating read in the Sandman Slim. We can't wait to see the fourth one. And, you know, we'd like to bring you on and talk again and see what's going on, and maybe we'll see you out and about. And... again, I mean, just thanks so much for, you know, I'd like to thank you, you know, for the author. Thank you so much for, you know, bringing your brain into books and allowing us to enjoy, you know, what you're able to create, because that's the real thrill of being, you know, not only am I, a host and with Suspense Magazine, but I'm also a fan first. And that's what I like to do. I like to thank you guys for doing that for us.
Hey, thank you, man. I really appreciate it. And hope to see you at one of the conventions.
Absolutely. So you have a great day, and we will talk with you soon.
That sounds great. Take care, man.
All right. So again, everybody, that was author Richard Cawdrey and that latest book, Aloha from Hell, the third in the Sandman Slim series. It's available now. His website, Richard Cawdrey, KADREY.com, to find out more information about Richard. And like I said, you get inside his brain. He's on Facebook, Twitter, so you can, you know, definitely interact with him, which is the great thing that you're able to do nowadays with authors, is to be able to kind of interact with them, see where they're at, see what you like, see what they're doing, and things of those natures back and forth. And Richard is another great one here, that is another, you know, interaction that you can be able to get, you know, real feedback from, you know, what you have. Well, I'll tell you, it has been a hard-hitting, fast show, one of the greatest shows that I think we've ever done here with Suspense Radio. Our first guest, we want to thank, of course, our authors John Land and ex-FBI agent Robert Fitzpatrick, who are the two writers of the book Betrayal, which is the Whitney Bulger and the FBI agent who fought to brought him down. That book's available now. Go to johnlandbooks.com to find out a little in-depth detail, but you can find the book wherever it's sold. And again, like I said, we just had Richard Cawdrey on with his book Aloha from Hell and his Sandman Slim series. We are still packed here on Suspense Radio. We're going to be back next weekend, and we're going to be packed here, you know, for the next couple weeks. And next weekend is going to be a very exciting show. It's going to start at 10 a.m. Right now we have Tom Rob Smith booked. We're looking to get somebody else. The week after that, on January 28th, we're going to have Neil Barr and Jonathan Green. You might know them from Law & Order, if you guys watch Law & Order. And then, of course, in February, we have, you know, a lot of other people coming up. Make sure you go to the site, suspensemagazine.com, click on the Suspense Radio button to find out more information. Our January issue is out. You can get it for free. All you got to do is email me, editor@suspensemagazine.com. That's it. I send it out to you. You get 4 free months for free. It's free. How can you not like free? Our February stuff's coming together. We're going to have a lot of great authors, a lot of different interviews in our February issue that I'm sure that you guys would all love to, you know, see and listen to. So might as well go ahead and email me now, get it, see what's going on with it. And we are going to make sure that we're back here next weekend at 10 a.m., you know, with another great show for you. Right now it's the NFL playoff time for me, and Monday's Martin Luther King Day. I'm going to be off, so it's a nice three-day weekend for us. We will see you all next weekend here on Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. Again, I want to thank you so much for joining me and all the guests we had on, John Land, Robert Fitzpatrick, and Richard Cawdrey. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. Goodbye.